Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Area voters went to the polls in large numbers in yesterday's off-year election. Yes, there were races for mayor and city council and school board that are always important because the winners in those elections are the politicians who most touch our everyday lives. But this time, voters made another choice, and one with ramifications well into this region's future. They had to decide on whether to allow leaders to levy a 1% sales tax to support Charlotte's transit plan. This hour, we look at the decisions voters made and spend time talking about politics in general. We're joined by WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. He's here along with WFAE education reporter James Farrell, and here to help us broaden our look at state and national politics as we prepare for a year of campaigning for the midterms. We're joined by former Charlotte mayor and former North Carolina governor Pat McCrory. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Transit tax proponents can breathe easy. Voters said yes.
So tonight, we don't just celebrate a win. We celebrate a promise to move forward together. Thank you for your trust. Thank you for a vision. And thank you for believing that Charlotte's best days are ahead. Thank you.
That's Robert McCutcheon. He's the CEO of the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, big proponents of the transit plan. The excitement was palpable in that statement. Voters said yes, but it was close, Steve. What do you take from that?
Yeah, if you had asked me, I mean, I think I wrote back in August, I thought the tax was a heavy favorite to get approved. And then the opposition waged a pretty effective campaign with essentially zero money and made it a pretty close race. It was 7,500 votes separation, about 4 percentage points. I think, you know, that the Yes for MEC, the pro-tax group, needed probably all of that $1.72 million they spent to get it across the finish line. And I think also having this election in an off year with, you know, the first election in Trump's second term, I think also helped. I mean, I think we're going to look at some of these other races and see how well Democrats did. And I think that did give the transit tax a boost.
We talked to WFAE talked to a couple of voters. One of those voters was Marcia Prime. She shared her thoughts on why she voted for a plan that she says wasn't perfect.
We want to be able to expand our infrastructure and make transportation available to everybody. And with ourselves growing as a big city, we need the transportation to follow that.
But of course, not everybody agreed. The vote, as we said, was close. On the other side, Delaine Mead, who has supported past referenda, but not this one.
If they can't manage the system that they currently have, that's a problem, and they shouldn't be incentivized or rewarded with more additional taxpayer money.
So, Steve, we had larger than normal turnout for this off-year election. By the end of early voting on Saturday, I think 63,427 people had cast ballots. The Charlotte Observer reports that that appears to be an early voting record. What did turnout yesterday turn out to be?
Yeah, it was 22%, and if you compare that to 2 years ago, it was 15%. This, you know, the last time we had really a competitive mayor's race was in 2017, when Vi Lyles first won. Turnout then was 21%. So this has been the largest turnout in a long time for an off-year municipal race. And again, I think transit drove a lot of that. And I think a lot of it, like I said earlier, was Democrats just wanting to get out and be heard, even though it's not a national election.
Governor Pat McCrory is with us. One of the hallmarks of your career, Pat, as mayor of Charlotte back then, was the building of the Blue Line. A lot of people, and we've talked about this in the past, a lot of people said it's a boondoggle. It's a waste of taxpayer money. It'll never work. Boy, were they wrong. It's become a transportation vehicle, but also mostly a development vehicle, and a whole area of town, South End, exists primarily because of the Blue Line. What role do you think this latest transit plan plays played in the voters' decisions in these in this election to get them out to the polls?
Well, I think the blue line has been quite a success, except for the crime issue in recent months and some of the operational issues. I'm very, very proud of what we did. I'm a little concerned, though, that the mandate wasn't anything close to the mandate we had in 98 and 99 when we had two referendums. I mean, we were up in the high 60s and early and low 70s of support. The reach out for support was not citywide to get the votes. And maybe that was another reason, or maybe it was a strategy to just win as opposed to get a clear consensus of where to go in the future. I know I didn't get any mailings or anything at my house for the transit. And that concerns me down the road. Yeah. Being a big supporter of transit, we've got to have buy-in. And you know, during the first transit 10 years that I was involved in, you know, I caught a lot of grief and so did others. We had cost overruns, we had late delays, and we still caught a lot of heat. Now, without a clear mandate, will we be able to stick with it with just getting, because it'll draw controversy again as we start building these lines.
It's not a perfect plan, and it's a compromised plan that was compromised.
Very much so.
And we'll talk about this because of what the legislature's demands were just to get the thing on the ballot. And you were here as mayor of Charlotte, I think, in the very early days of the original plan, which would have had five rail lines throughout the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County and into the surrounding counties, which could have had both a development impact and an increase of the tax base impact, as well as being a genuine transportation tool. Is this one a genuine transportation tool?
No.
Is that why you think people didn't?
I think there were other issues too. Well, crime still was a big issue. There's no fact that the terrible stabbing of the Ukraine that brought to light some of the deficiencies we've let go of during the past decade and not checking for tickets and not having the safety we needed. I think that had a major impact. I think also the land use, the 2025 land use plan that I approved in 98 and the council and others did, you know, for example, didn't have multifamily in single family residents. We said we protect single family residents in between the wedges. That has changed dramatically by the current city council in the past 4 years. And I think there's some concern in even neighborhoods like Elizabeth and other neighborhoods about the future land use in Charlotte, which may have been negatively impacted by not getting that clear consensus, because it's a change from our 2025 plan.
Well, there was pushback, Steve, on this plan from Matthews, particularly Matthews Mayor John Higdon, who was adamantly opposed to bus rapid transit, which is what he's going to get now because of this plan, as opposed to the Silver Line rail going right into town. There was also some pushback from people on the lower socioeconomic ladder, like the Reverend Barber, who came out against this plan because he said it's a regressive tax and it's going to hurt the poor more than anybody in the whole thing. Do we have any idea of how those two factions voted?
Yeah, we do. I looked this morning, put the precinct results in a spreadsheet, and so the precincts with the lowest support for the transportation plan were not surprisingly in Matthews. I mean, they were at the bottom. The precincts that had the most support, I thought it was just kind of interesting. NoDa had the highest support, then Davidson, then South End, then University City. So a lot of young voters, a lot of, you know, people who use transit. And Mike, you talked about in the Black community with Reverend Barber. Yes, for MEC, the pro-transit group did win kind of most of what we call, you know, the traditional crescent. They didn't win it in large numbers, but they won enough. I mean, they won 54, 53, 55%. So they got their message across. They were very successful. And, you know, that was able to offset some of these more suburban fringe areas that voted no.
So the result of this yes vote on transit is a tax that will bring in more than $19 billion over 30 years, 40% slated to go to rail, 40% to local towns, for various transportation-related infrastructure projects, probably roads and sidewalks for the most part, and 20% to buses. When will we see the sales tax go up, and when will we see the first project start?
Yeah, the sales tax should increase, I believe, next summer. And then, you know, the first thing you're going to see in the transit plan, and this is pretty easy to do, is to buy more buses, hire more bus drivers, and increase the frequency of bus routes. That won't be finished immediately, but they can start that pretty quickly. They can roll out micro transit pretty quickly. Then on the road side, you know, the city will get its first $100 million. I guess sometime in 2027, we'll start receiving that money, or I guess they'll start receiving it earlier, and they can start going to work on projects. I'll be curious if the city kind of markets this at all. You know, a lot of other places that do special taxes for transportation and roads kind of like have a dashboard. They let people track what's being built. They have signage, you know, this is brought to you by such and such. I'll be curious to see if that happens or not, because there's not a lot of incentive. I mean, the tax does not sunset. This is it. This is, you know, it is being levied forever. And so will the city kind of lean into this transparency thing and say, this is what you paid for, this is what you're getting? I'll be curious to see if the future city council kind of asks for that.
So this plan is a compromise, and it's one brought about because of what we had to do to respond to criticism from the General Assembly in Raleigh. Governor, you know Raleigh well. You know Charlotte well. Charlotte's original plan was drastically changed to get permission from the Assembly for this referendum. What's your impression? I know you're a transit supporter. Is it better to vote for the thing you can get as opposed to saying no and working on a new plan down the road? Was this the wise decision?
Well, we've got it. So that's looking to the past. I think the main issue is going to be the governance structure, which is kind of a compromise made in hell.
Yeah, it's unwieldy. It's 27 people.
Yeah, so when you ask what is the council going to do, actually the council won't have a lot of feedback once the governance start. And then you're going to get it. Listen, I know this game very well at the local and state level. You're going to have a 27-member board, which obviously is going to have to be broke down somehow for, you know, how to even fit them in all a room. There's going to, I assume, some sort of executive committee or something. You can't get anything done with 27 people. And then the turf battles will occur, as if with any commission. Well, where does the council get to interfere with the commission's work? Where does the transit director? You know, where's the gray area of the transit director's authority versus the authority's authority? And then the state legislature. If the state legislature, I know Steve just mentioned that this goes on forever. Well, that's nothing is promised forever from the state or federal government. If you remember in 98, when we first passed the referendum, a year later, we had signatures try to reverse the tax. So there are ways to reverse attacks down the road if things go wrong. It can be through the legislature. It can be through a referendum. So they're going to have to do this right. And that's why my concern is, having under 55% or whatever the vote is, there are going to be people watching what happens. And so it's, I think it's going to be a greater challenge than I had. And people following me had in the 90s and early 2000s.
Various different entities, including the legislature and the city council and business people, have to make these appointments for the 27-member board that will take control of CATS. Steve, when does that happen? When does that board take over control of and ownership, essentially, the operations of CATS?
The various local governments and organizations need to make their picks now, this month, and then they have to start filing reports with the state to get this moving.
When we come back, the race for mayor, city council, and school board, all under discussion. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're recapping the results from yesterday's election around Mecklenburg County and into the surrounding areas with Steve Harrison, our politics reporter at WFAE. Former Governor Pat McCrory is with us, former Charlotte mayor as well, and James Farrell, education reporter for WFAE News. We'll talk about the school board races in just a second. But Mayor Vi Lyles is mayor once again. And Steve, it was a wide margin. How surprising was that, if at all?
Not surprising at all that Mayor Lyles won her fifth term, making her now, she'll be the second longest serving mayor in the city's history, second to Mayor and Governor McCrory. I think there was a bit of a surprise. So she ended up with 70% of the vote. And, you know, after all that has happened in the past year with things like the controversy over the settlement with the police chief and the murder on the Lynx Blue Line and crime uptown, I think some people thought that her support might weaken a bit, you know, that she might only get 65% of the vote, maybe less. But in the end, it was almost an exact replay of 2 years ago. I think that 2 years ago, she got 74%. This year, it dropped to 70, an overwhelming victory, an overwhelming mandate. So just all of the controversy that Mike, we've talked about on the show many times over the past year did not impact that race very much at all.
Although it impacted individual voters because one of them, Geraldine Capel, voted for Vi Lyles, but she said she did so without enthusiasm because there wasn't much of a choice.
I think Vi is like, we didn't have any other option as far as I'm concerned. So I voted for her, though I didn't particularly like her, but we didn't have much of a choice.
Why is that? Why have there been no, not to besmirch the people who ran against her in this election, but why have there been no really serious, strong candidates for mayor to go up against Vi Lyles in recent election cycles?
I think in the general election, you just look at the math, that it's just almost impossible for a Republican to win a citywide race in Charlotte. That deters a lot of candidates. And then, you know, and I just think, again, in the Democratic primary, if you go back 2 months, there's people who run, but, you know, the mayor's record speak for itself. I mean, she wins and she wins big. And going back to that clip you played of the voter, Mike, I think it's interesting. You know, there may have been a fair number of people yesterday who were a little concerned about the city's direction, but they just were not going to vote for a Republican. I mean, they're just not going to do it in these partisan times.
And Governor, you were mayor of Charlotte for most of the 20th century, if I recall. 14 years, I believe. Did you face something similar? In other words, were there races in which you really had no serious competition?
Yes, I had three or four races out of my seven. Once I got in, it's tough to go after the incumbent, especially if the people have positive feelings about the incumbent. The difference was we were a two-party city at that point in time. And I got a lot of the independent vote and Democrat and some Democratic vote. We are a one-party town now, totally a one-party town. And the Ed Peacock race proves that. Ed Peacock, a moderate Republican, ran to seek Democrats dissatisfied with the city and independence, and he was wiped out. And so when people say we want more choices and more competition, the Democratic town, very similar to our Republican suburbs, only want one party. And we have become a city similar to Portland and Atlanta, where the city is blue and the suburbs, Union County, Lincoln County, Cabarrus County, Gaston County, are totally red. And so we probably have more political segregation and sadly other segregation in our region, like other urban areas of our nation, and I'm very concerned about that.
Our future. Ed Peacock had this to say to the Observer yesterday or last night. From start to finish, he said, "I feel like it's the best campaign that I've run. I've received lots of affirmations from Democrats who tell me, hey, we want balance. We know you're a constructive voice. We know you're not MAGA crazy. And again, I sort of sense that there's a real response for a moderate in the market." Yet the Republicans, he and Krista Beccari, both lost. Is it because of a response to MAGA Republicans?
I think that may have been a response, but you know, he was not a MAGA Republican.
No, he's not.
You know, he served with me on my last term as mayor in 08 and 09. And so it was a strictly a partisan vote in a blue city. I said last night to several people, Abe Lincoln couldn't get elected in Mecklenburg County for city council, county commission, or school board. It wouldn't make any difference. So, you know, I told Ed and his wife last night, who had the courage to run, but this is probably the death of the Republican Party for the next decade of anyone attempting to get support and tell people they have a chance if a moderate Republican can. And that saddens me. And by the way, I felt the same way with our state legislature. We are gerrymandered in Charlotte-Mecklenburg for a total domination of Democrats, just like the Republicans are doing the same game at the state level. It's not talked about at the local level, but the Democrats draw the lines here too. But for an at-large seat, it's disappointing.
He was running at large. He's on council right now. Ed Peacock is on council right now, filling out the unexpired term of Tariq Bakari in the 6th District. But he'd been on council before, so he's a well-known name. His father was in politics in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Well-known name.
Chairman of the county commission.
But the at-large candidates who won all won with about 20% of the vote each. And they're the same people who already hold those seats. Dimple Ashmera, Victoria Watlington, James Smudgy Mitchell, Luana Slack Mayfield, Steve. And he, Edwin Peacock, came in well below with 10% of the vote. Is it just because they are incumbents, or is it because Edwin Peacock and Minson Kim were Republicans? And unknown.
I think it's
at least one of them.
20% that the four were Republicans, 80 or were incumbents. I'm sorry, 20%. Most of it was that Edwin Peacock's a Republican. I mean, that's just the reality today. That and you know that there are many Democratic voters who are going to back their party, and then there are also Democratic voters who say, you know what, I've heard of maybe this Edwin Peacock guy. He seems okay, but in the era of Trump, I am not going to pull the lever for a Republican. I mean, that's just the reality of partisan politics today. And
I think we saw that, Pat, all over the country. Virginia, New Jersey, New York City, California. California's vote, and I was going to talk about this later, but we can talk about it now. Their vote on their referendum in response to Texas redistricting. California voters threw out a nonpartisan commission that decided on drawing districts and said, nope, we're going to respond to Texas and we want to put Democrats where Republicans were. Are the Republicans shooting themselves in the foot?
Yes. Yes. By the way, it's the historic nature of national campaigns at states and off-year elections. Whoever is the president loses power. Because people get fed up with the executive branch, but I think it's compounded now. You know, you've had recent controversy with Trump's pardons. Don't get me into crypto, but the pardons of a crypto guy, which is crypto is buying Washington and Raleigh at this point in time, which is the one subject that's not being talked about by anybody. But I think Peacock was impacted by Democrats going, I'm not getting anywhere near Republican because of the Trump factor. And, you know, there was some of this during Obama's term and off-year elections. And you got to remember, the Trump voter doesn't vote in this election. I mean, the Republican turnout was not good. And so in off-year elections, the Trump voter, the clear MAGA voter, only comes out usually very similar to the Obama voter. There was a clear Obama voter at the time. They only come out when they're on the ticket. So you did not have Republicans who live in Mecklenburg County vote at the same percentage that they have in the past. So it's there's some self-inflicted wounds, no doubt about it.
Let's go through some of the district races. Steve, we'll start with District 6. It was the only real competitive district race on city council, and it pitted the wife of the former occupant of that seat, Tariq Bakari. Krista Bakari ran in his place. She's a Republican, and she ran against Democrat newcomer Kimberly Owens. In the last two election cycles, Tariq Bakari narrowly squeaked past his Democratic challenger. This is a whole different ballgame, what happened last night.
Yeah, this was a blowout. I mean, and like you said, Mike, in those last two races in 2022 and 2023, Tariq Bakary won by, you know, roughly 350 votes. Last night, Krista Bakary, his wife, lost by 3,700, you know, about 7.5 percentage points. This is the first city council district seat to flip parties since 1999, just a little bit of trivia. And I think it's also worth saying that if the Democrats had run a candidate in District 7, which is at the very bottom of the city, you know, Ballantyne area against Ed Driggs, they might have won that race too. They might have, you know, had an 11-0 council. They did not realize, I think, the size of the wave that we saw nationally and here locally.
It was Krista Bakary's campaign raised more money than Kimberly Owens. And Owens said last night, possibly the most exciting thing about this night is realizing that money doesn't buy campaigns. Meanwhile, Krista Bakary said with her campaign, we had accountability, that we had transparency. We would have had a council that was balanced. I don't know how you can balance a council with the two, possibly three Republicans against the rest of the Democrats, but it would have been more balanced. Let's put it that way. And then she said, we lost that tonight, and the voters of Charlotte might just get what they asked for. What did they ask for?
I think they asked for Democrats. I mean, I think that was it. That was the message. And I think, you know, I talked about the national impact on this race, but I think also, you know, there has been a lot of controversy around Tariq Bakary over the past year. I mean, Mike, we on the show, we've talked about it with the text messages he sent to the police chief and the settlement then in response with Chief Jennings. You know, we talked about that enough. That was in the news cycle enough, I think, to really break through to the average voter. It became such a big deal that I think there were enough people out there who don't follow this that closely, but who said, you know, like Bakary, you know, it just brought up some negative headlines. And I think that was a part of the race as well.
Any other council races we should talk about this morning?
No, it doesn't matter. The race is 80, 90% of the races were over in a very low turnout primary. That's why we're a one party town. And this election is going to make it even more of a one party town. That's determined in the primary, which means it'll probably go even more left, very similar to what we're seeing by the right in Union County and other counties in our suburbs. We have
Let me ask you, that going left is the thing that Republicans like to point to as it's going to be a disaster. So let me ask you this, because you ran the city for 14 years as mayor, as a Republican. Mm-hmm. How has the city changed in terms of direction, in terms of where it leans politically, not Democrat or Republican, but in terms of where the policies being made under Vi Lyles and the Democratic Council versus your time in office?
Well, taxes have gone higher. Property tax, we used to, when we changed, we always had a revenue neutral property tax. They don't even talk about that anymore. So it's getting more expensive town to live in. There's no doubt about it. So spending is much, much bigger than it used to be. The social issues have become much more prevalent. I think policing has changed drastically since I was mayor. I mean, when I was mayor, we had a huge crime rate in 95 and 130 murders, and we took it down to 30. We had the Target 100, where I targeted the top 100 criminals in the city. We had a teen curfew. We had tolerate no truancy. We wouldn't allow the homeless to sleep on the streets downtown. We had a very, very much tougher policing. In fact, I'm kind of excited about the new police chief in one way. I liked her a lot. I knew her when I was mayor, and she was dynamic, and I thought she sent a strong message. But I think the message of policing and public safety has changed drastically in the last decade.
I don't want to get too far off the election, because this is a topic for another show, but a lot of the problems that police face and complain about in terms of people being back on the street before they can finish the paperwork, people who have allegedly committed crimes, have to do with the lack of staffing in the district attorney's office, a lack of staffing for the courts, a lack of money for those operations. And that comes from the legislature, and they don't provide it. That's a Republican problem.
Well, we also have very liberal DAs. And I combined with Democrats back in 96, 97. I had a march to Raleigh to Governor Easley's office to complain about us not targeting the people we are arresting over and over again. So I put a lot of pressure at the local level with Republican and Democratic mayors to increase funding. And listen, I think both parties are to blame, but I think the philosophy of policing, which I think impacted the last presidential election, has changed in Charlotte and Portland and San Francisco and others. And frankly, the people in Union County, Lincoln County, and others think like that. And that's what I don't want to happen to our great city. But I'm happy with the new police chief. She comes from the previous, I know she was very supportive of a little more aggressive policing at that time.
Let me bring in WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell, because there were a lot of races for CMS school board. No matter what happened in this election, we were going to have at least two new faces on Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board, because two of the incumbents, Thelma Byers-Bailey and the District 6 incumbent Summer Nunn, decided not to run. But we also have two additional faces. So now we have four new faces because of who won in this election. Let's start with District 2. That was a contest between, I hope I say the name right, say it for me.
Shamaye Haynes.
She won, right?
Correct, yes, and she won by a large margin there.
How is she different from Thelma Byers-Bailey?
Well, one of the big things that Shamaye Haynes is run on is the idea of the community schools model, which is this idea of kind of featuring schools as the center of a community and that tries to facilitate partnerships with parents, families, and community organizations. So that was a big platform she ran on. She had Thelma Byers-Bailey's endorsement in this race. She made clear to me that, you know, she's been a longtime advocate in the community, initially had butt heads with Thelma Byers-Bailey, and she said that the community wouldn't see her as a rubber stamp on her opinions, but also knows that they worked constructively together while Byers-Bailey was a school board member and while Haynes was an activist fighting for, you know, issues in District 2.
And the other newcomers in District 6, and that race was won by Anna London on the school board. What can you tell us about her in 30 seconds?
Sure, yeah. Anna London is the president and CEO of Charlotte Works. She ran heavily on trying to link students up with postgrad opportunities and employment opportunities and public-private partnerships with the business community.
Still more to talk about with regard to the school board elections, which we'll do when we come back with James Farrell, our education reporter. We'll also talk about some of the surrounding races. And then I'm going to put the governor to work, and we're going to talk about politics and where it is and where it's going and where we're heading as a country and why. We'll never finish that discussion, but we'll start it here today. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about yesterday's local municipal elections and politics in general on this day after Election Day 2025. James Farrell is with us. He's our education reporter at WFAE News. Our politics reporter, Steve Harrison, is also here, as is former Governor Pat McCrory. James, in the school board races in District 1, Charlita Hatch beat incumbent Melissa Easley and Bill Fountain. And during that campaign, evidently, Easley made some comments following the assassination of Charlie Kirk that caused a stir. Political parties have not traditionally endorsed candidates for school board, but the Democratic Party made an exception in this case. They chose not to endorse Easley and instead turned to Hatch. Hatch won. Easley says it was because she refused to raise money and stay quiet about things that she knew were wrong. What is she talking about? What was she talking about?
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a couple things that went on in that race. On the one hand, you mentioned the Charlie Kirk comment. There had been some instances where Easley had voted sort of in the minority against certain issues. For instance, she voted against last year's budget. She voted against a contract increase for this educational consulting firm that became a bit of a controversial issue on the campaign and that created some friction with other board members. But the fundraising part of it was a big thing, too. Charlita Hatch raised a lot of money in this race. She raised more than $50,000, which is more than any other candidate candidate who ran for school board by far and more than what you typically see in a school board race. So when you look at it that way, that's kind of, I think, what led to maybe easily not getting the Democratic endorsement. And then when you take a step back, I think you saw similar trends in the school board as to what you saw in these other races that lean very heavily Democrat, because all six of the candidates that were endorsed by the local Democrats ended up winning their races, which led to these two upsets.
Yeah, Bill Fountain's a Republican. He came in 14 percentage points below the winner in this race, but he believed that with the other two Democrats in the race, that this would give him an opportunity to expose voters to conservative ideas. Those are his words. He accused CMS of putting, quote, a social and political agenda ahead of academic excellence. Did that criticism gain him any traction, or can we tell?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, that's in North Mecklenburg, that had a longtime Republican there before Melissa Easley won in 2022. So it's tough to say where that kind of fell in there. All we can say for sure is that Charlita Hatch ran a really well-funded campaign and a really stiff challenge on Melissa Easley and came out on top.
Dee Rankin, the incumbent school board member in District 3, was the only one who did not face any competition. Stephanie Sneed is the incumbent in District 4. Lisa Klein holds that position in District 5. And the outcomes of those races were?
Yeah, so Stephanie Sneed held on to her seat by quite a bit, and she was facing two challengers. Lisa Klein, who is the board's only registered Republican, lost to the Democratic challenger, Cynthia Stone. I mean, it's worth noting school board races are nonpartisan, right. But you typically do know from the ballot of who endorsed who. So again, another example of a Democrat winning a seat here.
And Lisa Klein lost by a relatively wide margin, if I'm not mistaken. Is that simply because of this so-called Democratic wave that we witnessed not just here but around the country last night?
I do think so. I think that played a big part in this. I think it really says something again that these all six candidates that were endorsed by Democrats all won their seats. And that even includes in District 1, where a challenger was endorsed over the incumbent. So I think there was a lot of voting along party lines. I know I was out at the polls for a bit yesterday, and I spoke to a lot of candidates a lot of voters who kind of were not really following the school board race. And I think that kind of lends itself to people maybe just seeking out the political party alignments of each candidate, even in a race like this that is nonpartisan. So I definitely think that played a big role.
James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter, thank you for being here. I'm going to let you go now because we're going to switch our attention elsewhere. But thank you so much for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
In Huntersville, Mayor Christy Clark and Derek Partee returned for a rematch from 2 years ago in that town's race for mayor. This is a nonpartisan race, but when she was in the House, Christy Clark was a Democrat. So what was the outcome, Steve?
Christy Clark won re-election very easily, got 65% of the vote. And, you know, 2 years ago, Democrats swept all of the seats in Huntersville. It was a very, very big deal for the party. And the Democrats had a very big night again last night, holding on to all of those seats.
Perhaps this is a surprise. I don't know. You can tell me. But in Cornelius, there was another rematch this year between Mayor Woody Washam and Dennis Bilodeau, plus a third challenger, Kenny Campbell. Last time around, Washam beat Dennis Bilodeau by 5 votes. He lost this time.
Yeah, he did. And it wasn't particularly close either. I mean, it looks like, I'm kind of looking at the screen now, 500 votes, roughly, in that rematch. So, a change at the top in Cornelius.
And in Matthews, all six town commissioners were on the ballot, and at least 3 were slated to be filled by newcomers. How did those races pan out?
Well, Mayor John Higdon won re-election. Right. He won re-election against one of the commissioners who challenged him. And then it's interesting, the other commissioners, there was a group of commissioners who were initially against the transportation plan and then came out, maybe not for it, but you know, oh, we should give this a chance, this isn't so bad, they lost as well. So, you know, going back, bringing the show back to transit and transportation, very, very unpopular in Matthews.
Yeah, 24 hours ago, Democrats had a terrible problem in the country. They had lost their way. They were rambling aimlessly in the wilderness with no hope for resurrection. And last night, their fortunes turned around. And this morning, it could be said that the Republicans are reaping what they sowed in many cases here. Pat, I want to spend some time with you as a former governor, former Charlotte mayor, who knows Raleigh well. And we talked a lot at the beginning of this program about the transportation plan, which is a compromise because of Raleigh. What is it that Charlotteans and perhaps Charlotte leaders don't understand about Raleigh and vice versa?
Well, Raleigh legislature is mainly dominated by a majority of people that were elected in rural areas and small towns. They aren't connected to the urban areas. I mean, this is where the Republican vote has gone in the last 40 years. These are areas that used to be strong Democratic holds back in through the 60s and 70s, but they've completely reversed. So we're a very segregated state politically. The urban areas are totally blue. The rural areas are totally red. Suburbia is now purple. It can go either way. And the independent voter will determine future statewide elections. But as far as with gerrymandered districts, the Republicans are going to listen to their constituents they control. And in fact, there's a danger right now as we become so blue and have no Republican representatives, one Republican in the city council, none in the county commission, none on the school board. I'm a little concerned. I know how Raleigh works. They'll go, the hell with Charlotte and the hell with other areas. It reminds me back when I was mayor running for governor the first time, I met with a guy in rural eastern North Carolina to get his vote. And he said, my voters don't care about where you live. I care about my voters. And that's the way it is.
It strikes me that you, Ed Driggs, Edwin Peacock, as Republicans, mm-hmm. have a problem. You are Republicans. How would you describe where you are on the sliding scale of traditional, fiscally conservative Republicans, country club Republicans, as they were sometimes referred to, versus the MAGA wing of the party?
I grew up with Eisenhower and Reagan, and I've always said I consider myself more of a Reagan-Eisenhower Republican. Most people don't know who Eisenhower is anymore, but that's why I'm so big in infrastructure, because Eisenhower was an infrastructure president.
Yeah, he built the interstate highway system. Yeah,
exactly. And Democrats. So, the party is, Donald Trump has changed the party. Listen, I was an example of that in the U.S. Senate campaign that I ran. I had a 30-point lead when I announced for Senate. I had 94% approval among Republicans when the president endorsed Ted Budd. I might as well left the state, not even campaign. I lost by over 20 points, and he has total control of the primaries, very similar to certain caucuses have total control of the primaries in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. You do not go against things in the primary on both parties.
Democrats swept the major races, three major races in Virginia, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, all won. They gained, I think, 14 seats in the state general assembly there, whatever they call it, House of Delegates. Democrats expanded their position there. They took the governor's office in New Jersey. They won the mayor's race in New York City, Proposition 50 in California. The redistricting proposition won overwhelmingly at the request of the Democratic governor there. Are voters sending Donald Trump, are voters sending Republicans a message? I know that Trump is meeting this morning with Republican leaders to talk about this government shutdown. Yesterday, had they met, I'm sure they wouldn't have budged. Are they getting a message?
Oh, I think they get it, but neither party wants to play the game. We all talk about bipartisan, but actually we're getting more and more in our corners. You know, the Democrats saying, we got to fight Donald Trump. He plays hardball. We got to play hardball. And, you know, I think that impacted Ed Peacock. Yeah, we know Ed Peacock's a moderate. We probably do need a little more diversity on the city council. Tough. We're not going to put up. We're playing hardball from now on just because Trump does. And by the way, the Republicans felt that way with Obama. So we're going more and more into our corners. And the you know, one reason I was very active in No Labels with Joe Lieberman and Ben Chavis, who became very close friends of mine. I'm so lucky I got to know Ben and Joe Lieberman, and I mourn Joe Lieberman's death, is that they were two individuals along with me who we got in a room together and we agreed on 80% of the issues because we talked to each other. But the political system now is fought in the primaries, and in the primaries there is no compromise. And that's
can
true.
That be fixed? Can that be fixed? Because that's a construction of a lot of different things. Can
the
that
way
fixed?
It's fixed is usually both parties go too far. And this is the history of politics in America, is when one party goes too far to the left or right, there usually is pushback. But, and right now there's pushback against Trump.
But isn't the fix ending gerrymandering, having nonpartisan commissions draw districts nationwide? Isn't that part of it? Isn't the end of Citizens United part of it? And will anything change if we don't make at least one of those things change?
I don't know. Well, California just ended their commission. Democrats just ended the commission in California.
Well, because they had to. They had to.
Well, that's the point. You make my point. And as far as United, what's ironic, we as Republicans fought for United, the hearing, Citizens United, because the unions were given a pass and could give unlimited money. Then we didn't know there were big Democratic money, and money has, super PACs has changed politics. I mean, it's just, and by the way, the crypto industry, super PACs, is the largest giver of money in Washington, D.C., and they're also giving to Raleigh, both the governor and the Republicans. It's super PACs don't care what party you are. They're going to go after their special interest. And that has changed politics since I've got in it.
We also have an interesting thing going that goes on in North Carolina that seems to be particular, and I'm sure there are other states that have a similar problem, but this is particular to North Carolina. The Republican-controlled legislature has been taking steps for years to steadily weaken the control and remove power from the office of the governor. They did it to Roy Cooper. They did it to Josh Stein. They're doing it now to Josh Stein, and they did it to you. What's that all about?
Power. This is the problem when you have total one-party dominance in any body, which I'm a concern for Charlotte, too, because usually when you have one total party control on either party, we see it in the state legislature, we see it with our city council, you end up having the struggles are not about policy, but about power, and usually corruption comes and a lack of transparency comes because all the battles are fought behind closed doors when one party is control. And that's, you know, in Raleigh right now, the Republicans have total control of the House and Senate. You don't know what's going on. Everything's worked on behind closed doors. Their biggest struggle is the power between the House and Senate. The Republicans are fighting each other, and you're going to see that with the Democrats here locally, where it'll be power struggles. It's a human dynamic in politics. And the gerrymandered, I don't have an answer for, because I agree with you, but a commission... The dilemma with a commission, it has to be appointed by someone. And guess who appoints the commissions? The politicians. And believe me, the politicians know how to count. So whoever's in the party in the majority will select a commission that better vote their way or the commission will be replaced.
But we are, as a result, tearing down democracy. There have been these accusations, yes, of a lack of transparency on city council and within city government, which I think holds some water. And then you have, yes, Trump moving the nation as a whole more toward autocracy and an oligarchy. And that's discouraging to a lot of people. And it's not, I don't think, what the founding fathers intended. Are we eating our young here?
Yes, I'm very concerned about the lack of transparency and, frankly, the lack of media, because media doesn't have the resources they used to. Investigative reporters don't pay anymore. They are not a profitable margin. And now in the media talks to only what their audience wants to hear. We see that on radio. We see that.
I don't think that's, excuse me. I have to take issue with that. I think we do see it on radio on certain stations that are right wing. I don't know of a left wing station. Can't name one. Fox News on television, MSNBC on television. But I think that local news, WBTV, SOC, CNC, us, newspapers around the country and other stations as well, do talk to both sides.
We'll agree to disagree. I'm not going to.
I'm
have
talking
that
to you right now. So if we're considered, I have 30 seconds. If we are considered to be liberal, and God knows the president considers NPR to be liberal, I'm talking to you.
Yeah. No, I think NPR is more biased, and I think BT when I was on it was more biased.
You think?
And, yeah. Well, by the way, I wasn't biased enough. I mean, I had things I said about Trump used in future ads against me. So I went against Trump. I said critical things about Trump on BT often.
I want you to come back. I want to have this discussion.
I would love to, Mike. And you'll probably catch heat for me being on. But
no, not at all. But I have to let you go because we're out of time. That's it. Thank you for the hour.
Appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.